Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Big. Could the $9 billion sale to IMS Health affect Quintiles' local footing? And that's the headline on the front page. Actually, the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline. No longer driving its destiny, Quintiles' merger with IMS means a new direction for a Triangle giant. And this article is written by Jennifer Henderson. On Interstate 40, commuters inch past Quintiles Plaza twice a day, so accustomed to the big red Q and glimmering glass facade that the 11-story tower is little more than a flicker in their rear view. These days, that flicker may mean just a little bit more. Until this year, Quintiles Transnational Holdings Incorporated was the homegrown multi-billion-dollar brainchild of local entrepreneur Dennis Gillings. Begun in a trailer when Gillings was a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, Quintiles exploded into a multinational empire that helped establish the Triangle as a hub of clinical research. Global employment ballooned to more than 35,000 workers. Its splashy headquarters opened in 2009 and, located in the heart of the Triangle, served as a symbol of the company's strength. That changed in May when IMS Health Holdings bought Quintiles for $9 billion. While the deal was called a merger of equals, IMS shareholders took hold of 51.4% of a resulting entity called Quintiles IMS Holdings Incorporated. With a market capitalization of $17.6 billion and annual revenue clipping $7 billion, the possibilities of a combined company are hard to ignore. But also hard to ignore is what the merger means for the Triangle, and initial indications are far from rosy. At its first earnings announcement after the merger, CEO Ari Boosbib said leadership had identified an extra $100 million in cost savings, raising the question of how much of those cost savings will come from eliminating Triangle jobs. So far, Quintiles IMS officials are being tight-lipped about the company's plans. Company officials did not make Boosbib or former Quintiles CEO Tom Pike available for comment. Gillings, through an assistant, declined to address the company's future. But this much is clear. The majority of power is now in Danbury, Connecticut, and not in the glass building that once symbolized the company's potential. And the last remaining Fortune 500 company that called the Raleigh-Durham area home is now run by executives in Connecticut. Shift of power. When the merger between Quintiles and IMS was announced May 3, there was a new name at the top of the food chain, Boosbib. Boosbib, chairman and CEO of IMS Health, assumed those same roles at Quintiles IMS when the merger officially closed October 3. Pike, who had served as CEO of Quintiles since 2012, when he took over the post from Gillings, transitioned into a new role as vice chairman and president of Research and Development Solutions. Out of 9 corporate leaders for Quintiles IMS, 5, including Boosbib, are from IMS and 4 are from Quintiles. Out of 5 global business unit leaders, 3 are from IMS and 2, including Pike, are from Quintiles. Out of 6 regional business unit leaders, 5 are from IMS and 1 is from Quintiles. Legacy Quintiles members do hold all 5 executive team positions under Research and Development Solutions, run under Pike. But in a telling fact, most of the corporate leaders who came from Quintiles have had relatively short tenures at their legacy company. As to what extent the merger may impact employees outside of the executive team, that remains to be seen. Quintiles IMS has said the two companies are complementary and that the merger is to add value, not just savings. Although there may be some consolidation of certain functions and changes in global leadership roles, Quintiles IMS's headcount has remained fairly constant in the Greater Triangle area since the merger was announced in May. Quintiles IMS spokesman Phil Bridges says, "If there are reductions in the Triangle, competing contract research organizations or CROs may swoop in to hire those employees," says Ted Connor, Vice President of Economic Development and Community Sustainability at the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. "Those companies would snap up talent in a heartbeat," Connor says. He adds that if the merger had occurred in an industry unfamiliar to the Triangle, he'd be more alarmed. "But we are at the center for CROs in the country, perhaps the whole world, and talent is in demand," he says. Typically, in mergers, there will be some duplicate job positions. Whatever happens with those positions, they'll be greatly appreciated at other companies. Quintiles IMS declined to provide a current headcount for the Triangle and globally. The company provided a total headcount of 50,000 in October. As of 2015, Quintiles had 2,500 employees in the Triangle. Fast rise to prominence. Quintiles was incorporated in 1982, a little more than a decade after Gillings began teaching biostatistics at UNC, counseling students on performing research for other departments on campus. However, an unexpected request from German pharmaceutical company Hoechst, now Sanofi Aventis, sparked what would become the foundation of Quintiles and a new industry it would pioneer. In 1975, Hoechst came to Gillings for help looking into whether a number of deaths were tied to its new diabetes drug. Gillings ultimately reached a recommendation that certain elderly patients with excretion problems should not be prescribed the drug. Pleased with the process, Hoechst returned to Gillings to outsource more of its research, and other drug companies followed suit. Gillings and fellow biostatistics Professor Gary Koch founded Quintiles in 1982, but it wasn't until 6 years later that Gillings left his gradebooks behind for good. The popularity of the new contract research organization took off, with pharmaceutical companies realizing the efficiencies of sending their crucial clinical trial needs out of house. Quintiles went public in 1994, raising $35.5 million. 7 years later, Gillings took Quintiles private again in a $1.7 billion leveraged buyout. I felt that Wall Street undervalued the company and that Wall Street analysts lacked an understanding of the company, and that affected the stock price, which in turn affected employee morale, Gillings said at the time. Quintiles held a second IPO in 2013, raising $947 million. Gillings stepped down as chief executive officer of Quintiles in 2012, ceding leadership of the company to Pike. Gillings departed from his post as board chairman in 2015. While Gillings also sold some of his shares in Quintiles in recent years, he maintained $1 billion in shares as of last year. Through it all, the company Gillings started as a side job grew eons from its original plans and expectations, scooping up sizable companies through acquisitions, breaching the doorsteps of 100 countries, and eventually joining the elite Fortune 500 club. And all along, one thing remained unchanged: Quintiles firmly planted roots in the Triangle. Uncertain local future. After the merger, the company said Quintiles IMS would maintain dual headquarters in Danbury and Durham. The home of a headquarters can be critical, in part because that can impact how a company contributes to the community. In 2007, Gillings gifted $50 million to UNC Chapel Hill. After the merger, the Durham Chamber's Connor says he expects Quintiles IMS to continue to be a strong advocate for the Triangle. The company's employees live here and wanted to be involved in the community, he says. But there's cost cutting ahead, which could have an impact on the company's presence in the Triangle. On November 2, Boosbib said at the top of Quintiles IMS's earnings call that the company had doubled its cost savings projection since the time of the merger announcement. The company's integration teams have identified additional cost synergy opportunities, and as a result, I am pleased to announce we are doubling our cost synergy target, raising it from $100 million run rate annual savings to $200 million run rate annual savings exiting 2019, Boosbib said. Boosbib further said the savings will be derived not from client-facing resources, but from areas like duplicate infrastructure and back-office functions. In particular, Boosbib mentioned areas of overlap in information technology, human resources, and global delivery network. Tim Evans, an analyst at Wells Fargo Securities who covers Quintiles IMS, says, "The IMS management team has a pretty good track record for exceeding expectations on cost synergies." Jefferies analyst David Winley says of the merger, "What is a benefit to employees in Durham is the fact that IMS and Quintiles are pretty different businesses. IMS is more a data business, sales and marketing, whereas Quintiles is more R&D focused, meaning you don't have as much redundant activity or staff." At the same time, he adds, "When you're looking for $200 million in synergies, that means there are some redundancies that they expect to address or eliminate." Both Evans and Winley say the biggest challenge for Quintiles IMS moving forward is combining the cultures of two different businesses. I think there are some differences in cultures, differences in nature of the business that introduce some risk, says Winley, adding that IMS's data product business has less to do with the interpersonal relationship and more to do with information content of the product. I think it's going to be, how do you integrate the business without creating any sort of commercial disruption, says Evans. On the positives, the cost synergies do look quite attractive, and the company is also committed to doing share buybacks. Analysts see Quintiles IMS thriving in the outsourced R&D and data technology fields, but they also warn that integration of Quintiles and IMS may be cumbersome, thereby presenting unforeseen challenges. Merging cultures may be a challenge, too. Quintiles, for example, was known for its highly entrepreneurial culture, given its origins and the rise under Gillings. While Boosbib said on the call that it will take a little bit of time to integrate infrastructure and systems, he said, Quintiles IMS fully intends to deliver on its increased mark for cost synergies. We have, since the merger was announced, spent much more time and had much more visibility, and as a result, those numbers are a lot higher, said Boosbib on the call. So we are confident again because these are tangible costs and we can touch them. Boosbib's words are ones to watch in the Triangle as one of the area's corporate giants undergoes significant change. What happens remains uncertain, but this much is clear. The words that matter most at Quintiles Plaza now come from Connecticut. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, splashy event raises big dollars for arts. 30 years is something to celebrate, and ArtSpace did just that Saturday night with a splashy black tie affair that raised money for its arts programs. Nearly 500 people packed into Art Space on East Davie Street for the Collectors Gala, a swanky event that netted more than $180,000. The night included a live auction, be careful when you lift your hand, and helped Art Space raise 31% more money than last year. The dollars will support the Art Space Inspiration Fund. Honorary chairs for the event were Robert Zaytoon, John and Hope Holding, Bryant, Trish and John Healy, and Grace Ramsey. Art Space was leap of faith in Raleigh when it opened in the old Sanders Ford building in downtown Raleigh in 1986. Art Space was inspired in part by the popular Torpedo Factory Art Center in Alexandria, Virginia, and features open artist studios and a spacious floor plan. When Art Space opened its doors 30 years ago this November, downtown Raleigh was a very different place, Art Space Executive Director Mary Poole told the crowd. Vacant buildings, empty streets, it was nothing like the bustling and vibrant downtown around us now. This dentist delivers a special touch. Now, something to really smile about, Biz offers a hearty congrats to Dr. Michael Milano of Apex, who has been named the first ever Golisano Health Leadership Award honoree by Special Olympics North Carolina. The Golisano Health Leadership Award was established earlier this year to recognize an individual or organization that is dedicated to improving the health of people with intellectual disabilities and advancing the health work of Special Olympics. Milano, also now a faculty member at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Dentistry, has volunteered with Special Smiles, one of seven non-invasive healthy athletes screenings provided free of charge to Special Olympics athletes for two decades. He became a clinical director in 2001 while working in Texas and has served in that role for North Carolina since 2008, providing free dental screenings, oral hygiene instruction, mouth guards, and arranging follow-up care for thousands of Special Olympics athletes. Milano was presented with the award at the 2016 Special Olympics North Carolina Fall Tournament opening ceremonies in High Point on November 4. The following evening, he and 40 volunteers he recruited provided free dental screenings, oral hygiene instruction, and mouth guards to 165 Special Olympics North Carolina athletes. Gift helps young entrepreneurs. A Burlington couple has given North Carolina State University a huge gift to support entrepreneurship. Wolfpack graduate Andy Albright and his wife, Jane, are giving $5 million to bolster the NC State Entrepreneurship Initiative and the General H. Hugh Shelton Leadership Center, Chancellor Randy Woodson says. Andy Albright, who founded the insurance firm National Agents Alliance in Burlington in 2002, says he is thrilled to support NCSU students. "These kids have big hearts and they want to change America," he says. "I want to see more and more of those kids traveling the world, making a difference and going for it." Woodson says the Albright's gift has helped the school exceed $1 billion in giving as part of a goal of $1.6 billion by 2021. Great job, and here are the keys to your brand new BMW. Congratulations to Shantavia Lee of the Raleigh Division of Meritage Homes, the winner of a national sales contest held in September. Lee, the on-site agent at Durham's Meadows at South Point Townhome Community, won a new BMW 528i. "I love my job," Lee says, "and I was thrilled to win this award." Carrie Cece jumps back in the saddle. Call this version 3.0 for Carrie business executive Joe Cece. Cece in the 1980s and 90s built a career around the publishing and cable industries until switching to the technology markets and moving to Raleigh in 2001 to take over as president and CEO of BTI and later Carrie-based Global Knowledge. Now he's shifting into a business where he can be his own boss and at his own breakneck pace. Cece in January is opening up what will be the Triangle's second franchise location for Cycle Bar, a high-energy indoor cycling concept that's expanding across the country with its rock concert-like vibe and pay-per-class options. Cece has been an outdoor cycling enthusiast for years and even completed one of the toughest stages of the Tour de France in 2006 in about 11 hours. "Although I've never been big into indoor cycling classes, Cycle Bar is different," he says. "The platform is very, very cool. This is doing something for me." And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, growth in Triangle housing permits slows down in third quarter. The number of new single-family building permits issued to builders in the Triangle grew an anemic 2% in the third quarter and was actually down quite a bit in both Wake and Durham counties, according to the latest report by The Market Edge, a research firm that tracks residential and commercial building permits in markets across the Southeast. But there have been a couple of good economic reasons for a slowdown, says Rich Van Tassel, president of Royal Oaks Homes in Raleigh. For one, he says, the new home market is in balance relative to annual job creation and household formation. In other words, builders in the Triangle are not getting overzealous in starting construction for new speculative housing units like many had before the recession hit in 2008. Second, development of new vacant home lots is being delivered at a slower pace than the market absorption rate. Many Triangle submarkets have 18 or fewer months' supply of vacant developed lots, while it generally takes 24 months to deliver a new lot, Van Tassel says. This pinch in lot supply and demand inhibits a home building market's ability to grow, so right now it is just sustaining. A third factor is land. Lot and supply-side price increases are pushing builders up in the price, which is being passed through to the buyers. The market has followed along so far, he says, but that it has cooled a bit does not surprise me, especially in the higher price ranges. Historic Capitol Club building sold, signs major tenant. The historic 12-story Capitol Club building on Martin Street in downtown Raleigh has been sold, and entrepreneurial hub HQ Raleigh has agreed to a deal to anchor 5 floors of office space in the building. Raleigh-based American Residential Investment Management, led by managing partner Matt Fritter, paid $7.4 million for the Martin Street building that's listed on the National Registry of Historic Places, according to county records. The seller was Zebulon businessman and real estate investor Tom Hendrickson. Raleigh Hotel rebranding with $3.5 million in renovations. A 114-unit Regency Suites hotel on Capitol Boulevard in North Raleigh is under new management and soon will be undergoing an extensive renovation and conversion to become a more upscale Four Points by Sheraton hotel. PM Hotel Group President Joseph Bojanowski says the planned $3.5 million renovation of the property will involve the renovation of all guest rooms, lobby, and public areas, plus the addition of new technology capabilities and a bar-pub area. The renovation is expected to be complete in January 2017. project backed by Nobel Prize winner approved for Franklin Street. Chapel Hill Town Council has approved plans for a local Turkish foundation backed by Nobel Prize winner Aziz Sankar to build on Franklin Street where a hotel was previously planned. The special use permit will allow the Aziz and Gwen Sankar Foundation to build a 13,000 square foot clubhouse and guest house at what is currently a vacant residential property at 1609 East Franklin Street near the intersection of Elliott Road. The foundation is buying the 2-acre property from Raleigh real estate investor Don Walston, who bought the land in 2007 with plans to build a 6-story hotel. That was shelved in January after agreements couldn't be reached with the town. The Sankars have said the goals of the center will be to expand their efforts started at the Carolina Turkish House they opened a few years ago near the UNC Chapel Hill campus to host speakers, programs, and exhibitions related to Turkish history, culture, and contributions to the arts and sciences. The house also provides short and medium-term housing for Turkish graduate students and visiting scholars. Aziz Sankar, a native of Turkey, is the Sarah Graham Keenan Professor of Biochemistry and Biophysics at the UNC School of Medicine. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2015 for his work in the studies of DNA repair. Despite Hurricane Matthew, Triangle home sales up in October. While the Triangle was spared from the most serious of Hurricane Matthew's flooding and destruction that hit eastern North Carolina in October, the market still lost a good 3 days of selling activity due to the widespread power outages and cleanup that followed. Still, undeterred, October home sales in the Triangle were up 5.7% compared to last year, and sources say the market is showing similar momentum headed through November. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We are fortunate that we own a holiday. It would be nice to have a second." And that is from Kerry Doty, president and CEO of Butterball LLC, the largest producer of turkeys in the U.S., speaking at Triangle Business Journal's Power Breakfast event on November 17. And now we turn to the On Transportation and Energy page, written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, Amazon Wind Farm Rises in Eastern North Carolina. The Amazon Wind Farm is on track, and many of its turbines are towering over farmland near Elizabeth City. That's in spite of a similar project, Timber Mill Wind, being denied a key permit it needed to get started a few miles to the south. As of November 16, 72 massive turbines already line the sky in eastern North Carolina, part of the under-construction wind farm developed by Iberdrola in Pasquotank and Perquimans counties to support Amazon's operation. By the end of the year, 104 turbines will be active, says Craig Poff, Iberdrola Business Development Director. Already the farm is benefiting the economy, he says. 71 out of the 220 employees at the site are local, and they've spent $15.8 million locally, not including hotels and restaurants. He says everything is on track to be operational before 2017. In addition to the turbines, the operations and maintenance building, which will one day house 10 permanent employees, is nearing completion, he says. The $400 million project has its critics, however. While it has overcome legal challenges, there is still some of the same sentiment that may have led to developer Apex Clean Energy's rejection in Perquimans County. Poff says he's tackling community questions through transparency, providing regular updates to commissioners. Poff says that once the Amazon wind farm is up and running, he hopes it will alleviate concerns expressed by nearby residents on everything from decibel level to shadow flicker. But sentiment isn't the only challenge wind farms may face. While a bill that wind farm developers called a wind killer failed to pass the last legislative session, it could be revived. Its proponents say it would protect military airspace from turbine hazards. If passed, that could deal another blow to Timber Mill. Apex must already review its options after Perquimans County officials denied them the required conditional use permit this month. The case is expected to move to a courtroom. North Carolina's role. North Carolina, it seems, is a big part of Amazon's sustainable strategy. The Seattle e-retailer is on track to exceed its goal of 40% renewable energy by the end of 2016, and it's thanks to its dealings in the state. In addition to the wind farm, the company announced this month that it had contracted with Dominion for a massive solar development in Virginia. And a North Carolina company, Chapel Hill's Strata Solar, has been named the developer on the project. It's a big deal for Strata, says Brian O'Hara, Senior Vice President of Strategy and Government Affairs for the company. For perspective, Strata is building about 80 megawatts of solar capacity for the Amazon project alone. Its total solar build out at the end of 2016 for its entire history is about 1,200 megawatts. Number of RDU passengers rises in October. In the month of October, Raleigh-Durham International Airport reported an 8.8% increase in in-plane passengers. The airport saw a total of 493,170 passengers, compared to just over 453,000 in the same month in 2015. Of those flights, 11,525 were international, a 42% increase year over year. New Orleans flight, only the beginning. Allegiant Air's new direct flight to New Orleans from Raleigh-Durham International Airport, set to debut February 16, is just part of the airline's long-term strategy for the airport. That's according to Lucas Johnson, Vice President of Planning and Pricing at the Las Vegas-based airline, who says the newly announced flight took months of discussions to implement. We typically will analyze routes long range, he says. A lot of what happens is based upon aircraft availability and when economic conditions look right for our business model. Of the target routes the airport had left on its bucket list a month ago, only Kansas City, San Diego, and San Juan, Puerto Rico remain. The airport does a good job, Johnson says. They have their own target list for the community and they know the right airlines to pitch each of those routes to. He added that the carrier has had discussions with the airport about additional destinations. While Johnson would not be specific, he says Allegiant is a leisure-focused airline, meaning Kansas City is likely off the table. Johnson doesn't offer hints, but Allegiant has been publicly expanding its destinations over the past year. Allegiant announced in July that it would start flying out of San Juan. Johnson said airline execs are optimistic that additional RDU announcements will be coming, though not before 2017. And finally, in a section called She Said It, the quote, "Don't ever think that school is done, that's it, because you are just, by the nature of how fast things are changing, going to have to retrain, reinvent, and reskill yourself." And that's from Fran O'Sullivan, North Carolina Senior State Executive and General Manager of Global Operations at IBM, when asked for advice she'd give graduates at a recent North Carolina Chamber luncheon. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The first headline, GSK gives $400,000 to nonprofits. GlaxoSmithKline has awarded 10 small to mid-sized Triangle nonprofits $40,000 grants each for their work addressing social determinants of health. The annual GSK Impact Awards, presented locally in partnership with Triangle Community Foundation, weigh applicants' commitment to six areas: diet and exercise, education, housing and transit, employment, family and social support, and community safety. The GSK Impact Awards are one of our signature charitable programs, says Becky Lynch, Manager of Community Partnerships at GSK. The awards focus on all of the things outside of the doctor's office that influence health outcomes, she says. Applicants for the grants must be nonprofits with annual gross revenue between $200,000 and $5 million, with the average mark between $500,000 and $1 million, says Lynch. GSK received about 65 applications this year and typically receives as many as 100 inquiries, she says. Applications submitted in the first quarter of the year require nonprofits to demonstrate how they're making the community healthier, according to Lynch, as well as how they are measuring results and collaborating with the community. From the original pool, 20 finalists are selected for a site visit by an external nonprofit expert and a panel review by GSK and community health leaders. Recipients are not restricted in how they use the grants, says Lynch. The GSK Impact Awards has operated nationally for 20 years and for 8 years in the Triangle. 4 years ago, GSK steered the focus of the awards from traditional healthcare organizations like low-income clinics and those focused on preventative screening, says Lynch. Biogen names leaders for a hemophilia spinoff. Biogen has tapped two new executive management members for its planned hemophilia spinoff, Bioverativ. The company has named Rogerio Vivaldi Executive Vice President and Chief Global Therapeutic Operations Officer of Bioverativ, and John Green Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Biogen said in a release that the spinoff is expected to be completed early next year. Vivaldi previously served as Chief Commercial Officer of Spark Therapeutics and was co-founder, president, and CEO of Minerva Neurosciences, Biogen said. Green formerly held positions as CFO at Willis Group PLC and HSBC Holdings. Bioverativ is a unique opportunity to join a new company with a strong commercial business, growing pipeline, and an experienced team dedicated to delivering results for patients, providers, and caregivers, said Vivaldi. I am passionate about improving lives through innovative therapies and ardent patient advocacy and believe Bioverativ shares this vision. In August, Biogen disclosed additional details about the spinoff amid rumors of a possible takeover by such companies as New Jersey-based Merck & Company and Irish drug maker Allergan. The new company's name creates a clear connection to our Biogen heritage and biotech focus, Bioverativ CEO John Cox said in a statement at the time. Earlier this year, Biogen CEO George Scangos announced he would be stepping down to spend time with family. Biogen operates a 1,300-person manufacturing facility in Research Triangle Park. In June, Biogen said it would close its manufacturing facility in Boston, increasing activity at its RTP site. UNC, Duke, and CSU offer post-election counseling. In the aftermath of a polarized presidential election, Triangle universities have kept busy with their response efforts. UNC Chapel Hill, NC State University, and Duke University are all offering counseling services to their students after the election. In the past week, we have heard inspiring examples of faculty using the opportunity to have students of differing political beliefs share their views and engage in respectful dialogue on what it means to be a democracy. We also have heard a few troubling examples in which students felt uncomfortable expressing beliefs that differed from the instructors or fellow classmates. We take all these matters very seriously, reads a letter from the UNC leadership November 16. A spokeswoman for UNC said the university is not aware of any hate crimes or similar reports following the election, and a spokesman for Duke said there have been no significant incidents. A spokesman for NCSU did not report any incidences. Durham Company adds cash infusion. A Durham-based stent maker has raised about $25.8 million of a $30 million equity and debt offering. The date of first sale was June 20, according to a document Micell Technologies Incorporated filed with the SEC on November 18. Micell's lead product is MyStent SES. It is available for sale outside the U.S. but has not yet received FDA approval, according to the company. Back in 2013, Micell linked a development and distribution agreement for the stent system in China with Hefei Life Science Technology Park Investment and Development Company. In 2009, the company raised $5 million in debt financing from existing investors and also took in $15 million from St. Jude Medical. Micell declined to comment on the offering. Quintiles IMS to acquire clinical trials division of New Jersey firm. Quintiles IMS has agreed to acquire the clinical trials division of Rochelle Park, New Jersey-based TKL Research, a dermatology-focused clinical research organization. The deal, which is expected to close in the fourth quarter of this year, will see the division become part of legacy Quintiles company Novella Clinical, according to a release issued November 21 by TKL. Morrisville-based Novella was acquired by Quintiles 3 years ago for $147 million. TKL will continue to operate its research clinics division. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. Oh, and earlier we read an article concerning GlaxoSmithKline giving $400,000 to nonprofits. I neglected to name the 10 winners. So the winners are, for the GSK Impact Award, Book Harvest, Charles House Association, Club Nova Community Incorporated, Communities and Schools of Chatham County, Family Promise of Wake County, LGBT Center of Raleigh, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle, Seeds, Student U, and the White Oak Foundation. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. We'll start with his column, the headline on his column, Diaper Bank Fills Vital Need for Families. Packed into a 10,000-square-foot warehouse in Durham are 2 million disposable diapers that individuals and diaper companies have donated to the Diaper Bank of North Carolina, a Durham nonprofit that has distributed more than 1 million diapers to agencies serving low-income families since it began operating in June 2013. A second warehouse houses another 1 million diapers for the nonprofit, which distributes more than 100,000 diapers a month to 22 agencies in Durham, Orange, and Alamance counties. It also operates a branch on the campus of Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem that distributes 45,000 diapers a month to 18 agencies in 8 counties in the Triad, and a branch in Wilmington that distributes 5,000 diapers a month in 4 counties. It recently agreed to take over from the Diaper Train, a program of St. Xavier Center in Raleigh, the distribution of 60,000 diapers a month in Wake County. In 2017, the Diaper Bank expects to distribute a total of more than 2 million diapers to its partner agencies. And once it builds its current branches into sustainable operations, it will consider adding a branch in Western North Carolina. We work through nonprofits that work with families living in poverty, says Michelle Old, founder and executive director of the Diaper Bank. The critical need for diapers among low-income people is underappreciated, says Old, a longtime advocate working to protect women from violence. An estimated 1 in 3 families in the U.S. experience the need for diapers, and working families account for 3% of families that receive diapers. The Diaper Bank distributes to its partner agencies with each adult holding 1 to 2 jobs, according to a 2015 study for the Diaper Bank by UNC Greensboro. We are dealing mostly with working families, and they cannot afford basic needs for their children, Old says. And every time, they'll choose feeding their children over diapers and make those diapers last longer. Operating with an annual budget of $150,000 plus $450,000 worth of in-kind support, the Diaper Bank gets 30% of its diapers from community donations and drives, and the rest from diaper companies. Those include Huggies through the National Diaper Bank Network, and a partnership with Domtar Personal Care, a diaper maker in Greenville, with corporate offices in Research Triangle Park that also provides volunteers. The Diaper Bank rewraps all the donated diapers and counts on community donations for sizes not included in the bulk donations from diaper companies. It also distributes feminine hygiene products as well as diapers for seniors with incontinence who are living in poverty. In partnership with UNCG, the Diaper Bank conducts ongoing research and works through its partner agencies to connect diaper recipients with programs and services that can address other needs the family may have. We're not just giving them diapers, Old says. We're connecting them with programs that can help them in multiple ways to become self-sustaining. And now in the nonprofit news, Help for Diabetes. A market set up every Tuesday in Raleigh is helping those with diabetes make healthy choices. United Healthcare, Advanced Community Health, Interfaith Food Shuttle, and LabCorp are working together on a weekly mobile food market as part of a 6-month pilot program that aims to address the health needs of North Carolinians with diabetes. The market at Advanced Community Health in Raleigh helps 50 diabetic patients each week select healthy food. The participants get to fill up to 2 grocery bags with fresh produce to help control their diabetes or reduce their risk of the disease. Over 6 months, United Healthcare has invested $50,000 to deliver an estimated 32,000 pounds of food to participants. Fighting Clubfoot. A Carrboro nonprofit has an ambitious goal: treat children across the globe who are born with clubfoot. Miracle Feet of Carrboro was formed in 2010, and organizers say they have helped 20,000 children already. Organizers say about 200,000 children every year are born with clubfoot, which can be treated without surgery with the Ponseti method for a cost of about $250. Miracle Feet is working with the Global Clubfoot Initiative to treat 70% of children born with clubfoot in lower and middle-income countries with clubfoot by 2030. Saving food. Moving and storage company Movin' On Movers of Apex is partnering with the National Hunger Relief Organization Move for Hunger to help deliver food to local food banks. Movin' On Movers will collect food items from customers that might have been thrown away and will take it to community food banks. Helping Vets. The Art Institute of Raleigh-Durham gave local military veterans a lift November 17 with a special lunch served to those transitioning to civilian life. Around 80 veterans received a special three-course lunch at the school. The fourth year the event has recognized veterans. Big Dollars. Congratulations to the Durham Boys and Girls Club, which raised nearly $50,000 November 5 at its annual Great Futures Gala. Filling the Bus. Kroger customers donated more than 8,000 pounds of goods for a Fill the Bus drive held October 29. There were 3,125 pounds donated at the Durham store at 3457 Hillsborough Road. Another 4,835 pounds were collected in stores throughout the Triangle. The food drive was made possible through a partnership with the Durham Area Transit Authority, and all of the donations will assist the victims of Hurricane Matthew. A total of 4,835 pounds of goods were collected in stores throughout the Triangle, and combined with the 3,125 pounds from the bus donations to total 8,050 pounds. Thanksgiving help. Harris Teeter Associates and food volunteers assembled 2,000 Thanksgiving dinners November 15 for the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina on Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. Each meal included chicken, stuffing, mashed potatoes, yams, corn, green beans, rolls, and cookie mix. And now we move to the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, How I Use My Talent to Make Stars Out of Kids. Former Broughton teacher helps young actors break into showbiz. And this article is written by Jennifer Henderson. Terry Dollar, owner of Kids Unlimited Talent Agency, represents more than 300 actors based in North Carolina and neighboring states. While the Raleigh agency has focused on children for the past two decades, it has recently merged into working with adults as well. Helping peers get work was a natural progression for Dollar, an actress herself. I got started when I was 3 years old, Dollar says, noting her earliest gig was singing in a church. I did talent shows and competitions and even won a twist contest. Yes, the dance craze. After college, Dollar taught drama at Broughton High School. Her most famous student was Sharon Lawrence, best known for the television series NYPD Blue, for which she won a Screen Actors Guild Award in 1995. Dollar says she and Lawrence still keep in touch and that Lawrence even sang at her wedding. As for Dollar, she began a professional acting career when she was 30. Her first role was making $200 a day working on an industrial film. With professional work rolling in, Dollar needed an agent, so she secured representation by Boots Brunner, who Dollar says was North Carolina's first agent. When it came time for Brunner to retire, Dollar says she took over her mentor's agency. Focusing on children was an easy fit. Dollar's two daughters, who are now grown, were child actors, and casting directors consistently commented on how Dollar worked well with kids on set. The most fun thing about kids is that they're still not finished being who they're going to be. You have the opportunity to make a difference in a child's life and their family's lives, says Dollar. Some of her clients had made enough money acting to pay for college, she notes. But a talent agent's life isn't all fun and games. It's about constantly being on, says Dollar, who also works as program director at Raleigh-based Artsplosure when she's not coaching stars and coordinating callbacks. The typical day at Kids Unlimited starts first thing in the morning, checking email for any urgent matters and submitting suitable actors for auditions, which Dollar likens to ordering things in a catalog. Then there are requests from casting for the actors they'd like to see. Dollar's inbox also has requests like contract renewals for commercials and questions such as, should I get braces, she says. But her clients are landing big gigs. That includes work on television shows including House of Cards and The Walking Dead, as well as movies such as The Lone Ranger and the upcoming Suburbicon, directed by George Clooney. And working actors are crucial. Dollar says she doesn't get paid unless her clients get the job. For actors working at scale, most production companies add 10% for their agent, says Dollar. Those making much more, say $20,000 an episode, pay out of what they receive. Dollar says roughly 20 actors from her agency account for about 90% of the agency's revenue. While she declined to give an exact figure, she says this year's revenue is on track to be 3 times more than ever before. The agency has recently expanded into representing adults as well because it didn't want to lose the investment it's made in clients morphing into more mature roles, says Dollar. She says she currently represents 8 adults but is looking to grow that number. 2 government buildings in Raleigh sell for millions. This story written by Amanda Hoyle. Governor Pat McCrory's office has identified the buyers in the pending sales of 2 state government buildings in downtown Raleigh that are now likely slated for demolition and redevelopment. Station North LLC, a new corporation recently formed by Raleigh real estate developer and lawyer Michael Sandman, is the pending buyer for the 1.8-acre personnel training center at 101 West P Street, according to the governor's office. The state has reached an agreement to sell its ownership in the site for $4.85 million, as opposed to a land lease arrangement that had been previously advertised by the state property office. The pending buyer for the old steam plant site at 210 North Dawson Street has been identified as Caswell Square Medical LLC, a new corporation formed recently by Cary Sports Medicine physician Mylon DeGuglio. Caswell has negotiated to pay $1.75 million for the building that's been vacant since the 1990s. Neither Sandman nor DeGuglio were immediately available for comment about the deals. Both deals are expected to be a topic of discussion at the Council of State meeting in December. If approved, the sales of both properties are expected to be finalized within the next 6 months. The State Personnel Training Center facility currently has about 12 state employees working in the building, who will be relocated to the nearby Dobbs building in early 2017. McCrory's office also announced November 18 that a buyer has agreed to pay $6 million for the abandoned Charlotte prison site at 4100 Meadow Oak Drive, but the state has not yet identified the buyer. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, I hope I am wrong on this corporate hunch. In the corporate world, mergers and acquisitions are a fact of life, and so are the heartaches that come with it. Reporter Jennifer Henderson's page one story on how Quintiles, one of the Triangle's proudest and most successful companies, may be morphing into a corporate giant that may be unrecognizable in a few years is really sad. Quintiles was bought by a much smaller company called IMS Health for some $9 billion. The new company is now called Quintiles IMS, and its corporate headquarters is in Danbury, Connecticut, for all intents and purposes. Quintiles founder, Dennis Gillings, has long been gone from the company, although he owned a substantial stock in the company at the time of the sale. But the sale and the subsequent announcement of leadership slots should not leave any doubt as to who is going to be running this 50,000-employee company. It will be folks who work in Connecticut. Sure, CEO Ari Bousbib and his team will take issue if we said his company that has been most engaged with its community will simply disengage itself in the coming months and years. But that is exactly what I am saying. Repeated requests to talk to folks from Quintiles IMS about the seismic operational and cultural shift of this Durham company were thwarted with a no comment or CEO Bousbib will not be available for this story. Yes, things are changing. Frankly, that decoupling process started right after Gillings hired the last independent Quintile CEO, Tom Pike, in 2012. Pike's job was to clean up Quintiles and take it public again. He succeeded remarkably well at that. For a better part of 2 decades, Quintiles was everywhere, and while the company grew exponentially in terms of employee count and revenue, it dug even deeper when it came to community affairs. Just ask almost any nonprofit executive in town, and they will tell you Quintiles has touched their cause over the years. Quintiles IMS will continue its support in some form or fashion, but it will not be the same. During Quintiles' golden years, the executives who were running the company with Gillings had a personal stake in the Triangle. Executives such as John Ratliff, Paula Brown Stafford, and Paul Spreen were invested in their communities and took pride in using their corporate weight to make our region better. Bousbib already has indicated that cuts will come to save money, just like most mergers. We just don't know yet what operations will be hit the hardest, but I have a hunch. And now we turn to the People on the Move page for the spotlight is on Ryan Wells, Raleigh Division President at David Weekley Homes. A veteran of the home building industry, Ryan Wells is now serving as the Raleigh Division President of David Weekley Homes. Armed with about two decades of industry experience, Wells' role at DWH is primarily focused on its people, he says. While recruiting, onboarding, and developing, the absolute best talent is top of the list. I also spend a great deal of time researching opportunities for new communities with our land team, as well as working alongside our project managers to ensure operational goals are met, he adds. Wells' Triangle team is made up of 36 members. Nationally, Houston, Texas-based DWH employs approximately 1,350 people. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I'd like people to know about the total team effort involved in every community. Our project managers, sales consultants, builders, warranty reps, and support team do an unbelievable job on a daily basis. What are some of your major goals in your new position? Thankfully, the existing team is already operating at a very high level, which gives me room to focus on helping grow our market share here in the Triangle. We don't have a stated goal to be the biggest builder here in the local market, but we do plan to grow at a faster pace. Biggest pet peeve? Negativity. A great attitude combined with a healthy dose of determination, flexibility, and humility can overcome most any challenge. Biggest worry? Within the realm of home building, my biggest worry is affordability. Balancing land prices, construction costs, and related fees while bringing the highest quality and most affordable product to market is a challenge. Triangle area business person you most admire? Doug McMillan, CEO of the YMCA of the Triangle. Education, bachelor's degree in finance from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Family, wife, Angie, three children, Lucas, Isaac, and Lila. Last book you've read, Millennials and Management by Lee Caraher. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to Edward Marshall's column. Edward Marshall is an adjunct professor of management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. He's also an award-winning consultant and author and managing partner at the Marshall Group, LLC. The headline on his column, Keys to Great Place to Work Include Integrity, Trust. Morale in this company was down. Productivity was suffering. Quality issues were rising. Customers were increasingly unhappy. Senior leadership was pulling its hair out trying to get to the root cause of their increasingly serious business challenge. What did their people want? The holy grail of productivity, profitability, and innovation is found in understanding and tapping into the motivation of the workforce, that is, knowing what they want and providing it. That is particularly true for millennials, who will be upward of 60% of the workforce by 2030. They will not stay in an organization that does not motivate them. They have plenty of choices. When you look at the best places to work list, you see many of the same companies year after year. Here are five elements for a best places culture. Extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. Companies can try to motivate their people with benefits like car washes and massages, or even ping pong tables in the workplace, but research and our experience shows us that they are motivated by more intrinsic rewards, finding meaning in their work and being part of something that matters, and that makes a difference in the world. It's about identity. Who am I at work and why am I here? Is a question people ask themselves fairly often. Does this company stand for something of value? Does it have a mission and vision they can be proud of? Is the workforce doing something that matters or just going through the motions? A principle-based culture. Integrity matters to people these days. Company cultures like that of General Motors, Wells Fargo, Volkswagen, Takata, and others that lead to product defects, fraudulent behavior, and unauthorized services result in a demotivated workforce. Having a principle-based culture where leadership walks the talk creates an environment of trust and respect that is essential to high morale and productivity. Ownership feeds the soul. People take care of what they own, so giving the workforce ownership over their jobs, teams, work processes, and mission connects them to the inner purpose and direction of the company. Trust, not fear. People thrive in organizations where they are not afraid of retribution if they challenge leadership or make mistakes. They contribute when they are trusted and where there is grace, humility, openness, and authenticity. This is a collaborative leadership platform for a best places culture where people matter, can do meaningful work, can be their best selves, and then be honored for their gifts. And in our final minutes, we'll read this article written by John Downey. The headline, Solar Companies Have Concerns About Duke Energy Proposal. Reactions from major industry players to Duke Energy's proposals to change how solar is built and paid for in North Carolina range from cautious consideration to outright rejection. Brian O'Hara is head of strategy and government affairs at the state's largest solar developer, Strata Solar of Chapel Hill. He says some of the proposals from Charlotte-based Duke have been denied by state regulators before and should be again. But he says Strata could be open to some of Duke's proposals. That includes a suggestion that the state move to annual solicitations from utilities for new solar projects. If there is a way of doing things that is better for the utility, better for the industry, better for customers, we are interested in having those conversations, O'Hara says. He says the details of the proposals are not clear and will be vital to how the industry responds. O'Hara thinks it's worth hearing Duke out. Eric Lynch, who last month started Leeline Renewable Energy, his second solar company in the last 8 years, has heard enough. It's a non-starter, he says. The call for annual solicitations is coupled with proposals to significantly curtail the amount of utility-scale solar built in the state under existing policies. Lynch says those policies created a level playing field for solar developers in a state dominated by the regulated monopoly of its utilities. Under them, North Carolina took second place in the nation for solar on the grid. Giving up the leverage those policies give independent developers would gut the industry here, Lynch says. The solicitation process would give Duke and other utilities ultimate control over how much solar gets built. Duke made its proposals last week in its biennial filing with the North Carolina Utilities Commission on setting its utilities avoided costs. Avoided costs are a calculation of the marginal cost for a utility to add the next kilowatt of solar capacity. That figure is a key factor in the price which utility pays independent contractors. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.